All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm in my living room with the great Hunter Motz.
Great has clearly become diminished as a word, if I now classify. More importantly, though, we're here with Chris Ryan's Mystery Tea.
I almost called you the late great.
And the late great? Well, that may be prophetic.
Yeah.
It depends on how this mystery tea goes.
That's right. Yeah, Hunter wanted some tea, and I had some tea in a nondescript container. We're not sure what it is. It's loose leaf.
I already feel amazing.
It smelled pretty good, though.
Yeah.
It smelled spicy and delicious.
It is spicy and delicious, and it was in a raspberry sorbet pot.
Yeah, I have no idea how it got there. No clue. I imagine lots of people have teas in their cupboard that they don't know how they got there.
Mystery teas? Oh, yeah.
And it sounds like one. It sounds like a euphemism, you know? Like, oh, there's a mystery tea in his cupboard.
In general, if you wanted to drug your friends and family, that is the way to do it. You just slip something in a tea, in the tea cabinet, in an interesting box.
You going Cosby on me here? Yeah, we're not even a minute into this interview, and
hey,
you're like,
listen,
introducing
Uncle Chris,
date rape, you know, techniques,
listen,
to my
who
audience.
Who took who into the back of his van, Uncle Chris?
Well, there's got to be a whom in there somewhere.
A whom?
Who took whom?
Yeah. Let's get our relative pronouns correct, folks.
Yeah. I have friends who are grammar Nazis. I had dinner with them last night, and we determined that they're grammar Nazis, and I'm sort of a vocabulary Nazi.
Really? Can those kinds of Nazis work together, or is there like sectarian?
I think we have detente.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because like they say things like, they'll answer the phone and someone will say, yeah, is this Mr. And he'll say, this is I. You know, they do shit like that. Or what's the one that gets me? It's like, you know, it's always, I can't remember the example that really annoys me. But they do, it's one of those things that they do. And it's a case of it being, probably, I'm sure they're right because they're very smart and they do crosswords all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're that kind of people. They're right, but nobody says it that way.
But see, that's to me, like, ultimately, language is defined by the users. And
well,
language shifts.
But it depends
and
on the language. Like Spanish and French, there is an academy, you know, that determines what is correct. And it doesn't matter how many people get it wrong, it's still wrong, you know?
But the point is that that relies on people recognizing the authority of that institution.
Right.
And, you know, in English, in practice, the Oxford English Dictionary is responsive to word usage.
Right.
So if we all start using a word like...
Okay, that's word. Now, see, now you're into the vocabulary.
Yeah.
That's my Nazi zone.
Yeah.
Because I get really annoyed when people use words wrong. People say disinterested, meaning uninterested. That bums me out. I get annoyed by that.
Yeah, I can understand that.
You know what I mean? Because it means something different. And, you know, and you can see it happening. You can see it snowballing if you live long enough. And then it's like, oh, shit, another one, you know,
bites
another
the dust.
Word that used to mean something specific that now doesn't. But with the grammar stuff, I'm more of a usage, you know, might makes right kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. This is deeply uninteresting, though.
Well, I think the thing that makes it more interesting is when you start looking at it from an evolutionary perspective.
Here we go.
Because
here we go. That's why Hunter's here.
Because I think that's, to me, this is evolution in action. And the question is, you know, over time, language has been shaped and refined to become more useful to the users.
Right.
And they drop out useless features. So the past tenses get standardized.
They do and
the
they don't. They
do
also
they
complicate them.
Sometimes.
Right? They develop even more forms, and so it can go either way, as can evolution.
Yeah, as can genetic evolution.
Evolution isn't really about simplification, right? It tends toward complexity, I think.
Well, I think, you know, there are these sort of Precambrian explosions, and then things get whittled down, and then there's some sort of explosion again. So it's this series.
But you're talking about multiple life forms as
opposed
to the complexity of a
single
life
one.
Form. Right.
Yeah.
So we could talk about there being many languages and then fewer languages,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there's that kind of.
Well, and even within the language
expansion.
As well, you get all sorts of, you know, accents and dialects and variations, and then there are forms of, like, the whole point of the Oxford English Dictionary or any of the attempts to standardize grammar, or what happened with the printing press. When the printing press came along, they had to start to standardize spelling.
Yeah.
And that's basically moving it from a series of localized tools to there being a standard form of communication that makes the flow of information easier. It's no different than standardizing, you know, there used to be a million different types of screws, and then they standardized it down to Phillips head and flathead, or, you know, these standard gauges for interchangeable parts. And it's very much the same thing that happens with language to facilitate communication, is that you're regularizing the tools.
Right, right.
But I think the useful test is really the test, is what is practical and what is functional. Because if I go around and say, you know, and I'm really making a point of some obscure grammar point, then what's the function of that? Most of the time, what I'm doing is I'm lecking. I'm trying to show off my intellectual superiority to the group.
Lecking?
Lecking.
L-E-K?
K-K-I-N-G. So lecking is
never heard that word.
Well, I heard it's the primate behavior of trying to demonstrate status. I got that from Jennifer Jacquet. Who's one of my favorite people of all time.
What else did you get from Jennifer Jacquet?
One of those crushes.
A croissant,
that, no,
perhaps?
More of a crush than anything else.
A crush.
Brian Callen and I had a huge, like, it was amazing. Because so Brian and I had her on the show. We had her on the show about her book and her research. Uh-huh. And we started talking about it. And then very quickly, the podcast devolved into Brian and I trying to impress.
So you were lecking for her.
For her. Oh. And then she's like, do you know what you're doing? And she very gently, very politely called us out. And she said, it was very funny, because she said, actually, when men are around females they find attractive, the length of word they start using gets longer. Because, you know,
and thicker
girthy. That's a girthy word.
Girth Brooks. Yeah, that's interesting. Lecking, so also known as peacocking.
Yep.
In the pickup artist community. So I saw a lot of lecking recently. You ever been to Burning Man?
I haven't, but that seems like an amazing place to peacock.
There's a lot of peacocking going on. Yeah, like sort of maxi peacocking with all these art cars and outfits people are wearing, and there's just a lot of display behavior.
Well, and even being at Burning Man is a display, right? Because you get to say, oh, can't, next week I'm going to Burning Man, right? Or, oh man, yeah, I've got this amazing sunburn on my face because I just came back from Burning Man.
I got playa dust up my butt crack.
Because I was at Burning Man.
Yeah.
So it is, it's a great form of lecking.
Which I guess I just did by even mentioning it.
Yeah, you did a little bit.
I mean, podcasts are lecking in a sense,
dude,
right?
Of course.
Listen to us. We're so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a conundrum.
Well, it depends also but that's where you sort of have to dig down in your own deep, dark psychology and be like, why am I doing this? Why am I saying this? Why am I having this conversation?
Why get out of bed today?
Yeah.
Why am I even here? Yeah, you can't ask that question too deeply.
You can't?
No, you run into trouble, man.
Where do you just fall so far down your own navel that you get lost?
You become a nihilist.
Oh, Jesus. Lebowski.
Exactly. How long did it take us to get to Lebowski? 8 minutes and 50 seconds.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I blame the tea, to be honest. Like, this is clearly special tea.
Specialty tea. Yeah.
So how was the road?
The road was long and winding. It was great.
Good.
It was really good. Yeah, I went up the coast of California, did podcasts in Santa Cruz, two of them there, one with a sex researcher.
Oh, great.
She's not a researcher, she's a sex educator. Amy Baldwin is her name.
Okay.
I'm going to release that one soon. I don't know when I'll release this one. Are we doing my podcast or your podcast,
by
the way?
We can do either.
You want to co-release this?
Let's co-release. Yeah, high five, dude.
So I've already said welcome to my podcast.
Oh, welcome to Mixed Mental Arts.
Super mix this week.
Yeah,
even more mixed than normally.
So we had an 8-minute intro. to the Mixed Metal Arts podcast. Like, that was all the pre-roll.
That was pre-roll.
And now we're both podcasts at the same time.
We're so unconventional.
Jesus, dude. It's amazing. Amy Baldwin.
So Amy Baldwin, she's really cool. She and her mother own a sex toy shop in Santa Cruz, and they do workshops. And so I met with her. We originally scheduled it for the previous evening, but then she couldn't make it because she and her mother were doing a blowjob seminar together, teaching young ladies and I imagine
young men
who were interested in blowjob technique. Anyway, so had a great time with her. I did meet her that evening. We went out for a drink when she got back, but she was too tired to do the podcast. And it was very interesting because she's hot, right? So we went out for a drink, and it's like, oh, this chick's hot. This is nice. And she's totally like unashamed about sex and uninhibited and all that. And the end of the evening, she's like, oh, I'm really tired. I'm going to go home and go to bed. But I have a gift for you. And she hands me a bottle of lube.
Jesus.
And I'm like, oh, this van trip isn't going so great. But it was this like
me and my lube are gonna go back to my van.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, hey, I'm going to bed, but here's some lube.
Have some fun.
But it's this lube she says is the best. It's called Uber Lube.
Uber Lube.
Yeah.
Can you also Uber request Alice. It via your phone?
Yeah, exactly. They'll bring it by. Some guy will bring it by in his Prius.
But so, I was actually just on the way over here. I was having a conversation with somebody who had just finished reading your book.
Hitchhiker?
No, Sex at Dawn.
Oh, I thought the person you were speaking with
was a hitchhiker. Yeah. I actually met a random hitchhiker and they were reading Sex at Dawn. Mm-hmm. Sex at Dawn is now everywhere.
It's everywhere.
But they were saying that they thought that your book should be required reading for all of humanity.
Well, that would do wonders for my rent. Yeah,
it'd be amazing.
Wouldn't that be great? Talk about a bestseller.
Like, 7.5 billion copies in print. Take that, J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, hey, North Korea, we're going to drop them from airplanes.
Oh, my God.
Send a rocket over.
You want to talk about how you would bring down North Korea? Just dropping a bunch of copies at Sex at Dawn.
Think that would do it?
I think that would do
it. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's wonderful. I mean, it keeps selling. People keep talking about it. I keep getting emails from people saying it's changed their lives. It's very inhibiting to the idea I'm going to ever write a second book.
Well, that's kind of the challenge is that, why write a second book?
Yeah, why ruin a good thing?
Well, but it also,
It's like my cousin. He had his first baseball game in high school last week.
Uh-huh.
Right? He's a great kid. He's really, he's cool. He's about 14 years old. He's like 6'3", maybe 210 pounds. He's a big guy. First at bat.
Yeah.
Grand slam. First at bat in high school on the baseball team is a grand slam. And everyone's like, dude, quit.
Quit.
Just quit.
Now.
Like, that's it.
Wow.
It's not going to get better. You know?
That's amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, that's nice. That was nice to hear.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the interesting thing too, though, is that like Sex at Dawn is such a good book for sort of waking people up to the fact that there is this huge disconnect between what our culture teaches us and what our biology wants us to do, because obviously sex is the most primal.
It's up there with eating, shitting, sleeping.
Yeah.
The big four.
The big four. Eating, shitting, sleeping, sex.
Fucking.
But yeah, if you think about the big four, I mean, how eating is, I mean, there's obviously huge problems with the way that we eat, but it's not as out of touch with.
I don't know. I think there are arguments to be made there.
More than sex, you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think. This isn't something you can measure very accurately, but you think about eating. We don't know where our food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the conditions in which it's produced.
Mm-hmm.
We're totally alienated from the food process, most of us. A lot of the food now is grown in soil that's so depleted that there's very little nutritional content. So we're eating these big red tomatoes that have no flavor and very little nutrition. And right. so we're actually starved even as we're growing obese with calories. We're starved right. nutritionally. So, you know, and we're destroying the planet. All the topsoil's run off. We're using all these pesticides. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the whole sort of conundrum of the way food is produced and consumed, I would say it's at, yeah, I mean, you could argue that we're even more disconnected and it's even more detrimental to our well-being than the sexual disconnect. Because the thing is, when people are fucking, when someone finds a good partner and they have a good thing, it might not last forever, whatever. Right. You know, they have the expectations. But in the moment, fucking's great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, they're in the moment, if they have a good sex life, they're celebrating their animality together. Mm-hmm. Right. And even if it only lasts for, you know, 20 minutes or 20 years or whatever it is, but in that moment, I feel like they're returning to this primal state, if it's good, right? And with food, when do we return to our primal state, really? You know, I've never killed anything and eaten it. I've never, you know, I don't have that connection with it. I was talking with my buddy Kyle recently, who did a, well, I have two friends who've killed boars, wild pigs on in Hawaii.
A stick hunt?
One was Kyle with a bow.
Yep.
And the other was my buddy Simon Rex, both of whom have been on my podcast. And Simon, it was a thing where they had dogs that would chase the pig down mm-hmm. and hold it. And then you go up and you stab it with a big right. Bowie knife. And he did that. He sent me a picture this morning, actually, of himself, like with the pig, boar. The gutted yeah, boar yeah, over yeah. his shoulders and blood yeah. dripping all over him and stuff. So, I mean, even a novelty experience like that I haven't had. It's something I want to do in the next couple of years. Because I do feel some responsibility just to acknowledge the reality of stuff. But, yeah. I mean, we're so disconnected. It's like death, you know? Unless you are a healthcare worker who works with people who die, you almost never see it.
Right.
It's weird. So death, that should be another, the big five.
That's big five.
So we got eating, sleeping, shitting, fucking, and dying.
Yeah, I would say that is the big five.
That's pretty much all you need right there. Yeah.
Well, but I think that if you, also the big five, like if you walk someone through the big five, that's when you, like at the end of that process, after going through the big five, there is no doubt that your culture is massively out of touch with your biology.
Mm.
That's when it really becomes clear to you. Because like even, and you know, sort of birth is kind of the other one.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I recently had a conversation with, so a friend of Katie O'Brien, who I wrote The Straight A Conspiracy with, she's, her due date is literally tomorrow.
Hmm.
And I had a conversation with her and then Jenny Aguilar, who's in our community. And, you know, they were just sort of talking about the realities of childbirth. And because I've just sort of realized that I've actually never held a baby.
You've never, held a baby?
Yeah.
So you've never run for office?
Never run for office. I've practiced a lot on, you know, sort of Cabbage Patch dolls, but right. never worked up to the real article.
Wow, wow. Because you're afraid you'll drop it?
Yeah, it's like a huge amount of responsibility. And I just also...
Just too much time playing basketball.
Yeah, that is the problem. I have the wrong intuitions. I just want to dribble the baby.
But it didn't bounce.
Wait a minute. Oh, this one must be a muggle. but I mean, you know, that's potentially like... This is sort of like... It starts to become like the seven sacraments of Chris Ryanism.
Oh, we're back. I forgot about Chris Ryanism. We were going to start a cult last time you were here.
Oh, I got some news for you. While you were on the road, we started a cult.
Did you start it?
Yeah, we started it.
In my name?
Yeah, pretty much.
Really?
You're one of the central figures in this cult.
Oh, one of. So yeah. It's not my cult anymore. Now I'm some fucking second rate.
You want a monotheistic cult or a polytheistic cult?
Well, I'll have to look at the details. We'll have to look at the fine print.
I think you want a polytheistic cult. They tend to have more of a sex-positive attitude, I think, than monotheistic religions. I don't know that Chris Ryanism, if Chris Ryanism is a monotheistic religion, I don't know that there's a lot of sex going on.
But who's talking about religions? I'm talking about cult. I'm just talking about Charles Manson without the killing, you know?
Well, we are in LA, and we are in the part of LA where you would really, really like do some Charles Manson shit.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, that was dramatic.
Yeah.
Sneezing. That's the seventh sacrament.
the little orgasm or the little death or whatever they call it.
The petit mort.
Yeah.
Have you got another one coming?
I might.
Jesus.
I think I do. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
I get these sneezing fits. I'll sneeze like 5 or 6 times.
Why do you think that is? Is that a thetan coming out? Were you just getting a thetan out?
I don't know what that is.
A thetan?
A thetan? Yeah, I don't know what a thetan is.
So thetan is from Scientology.
The
alien ghosts that possess your body.
Do they tend to congregate in the nasal passages?
I think that they tend to congregate in your wallet, and that's why you have to like empty out the wallet.
The money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe.
So you started a cult.
So I started a cult.
Yeah.
Essentially because.
Good for you.
Yeah, it's great. No, but you know, the last time I was here, we were talking about the monomyth, right? Hero's Journey. And. You know, just sort of realizing that.
How come you didn't bless me, by the way?
I don't.
That was really rude.
Really?
I sneezed twice and you didn't bless me even
that's
once.
That's because you're also a god. As a god, you can bless yourself.
Do gods sneeze? Is that what a hurricane is? God sneezed on Florida.
Oh my God. Well, you know, it reminds me of that, the end of Ghostbusters when Venkman says, Ray, if someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
Sorry, I interrupted you. The cult.
So, we were talking about...
The monomyth.
The monomyth. And that essentially we, you know, have reached this place where one of the possibilities is we complete the hero's journey.
Right.
And we return to sort of living in line with the rhythms of our biology, keep all the cool shit. And, you know, I had this conversation with these two artists in the UK, Fantic and Young.
Oh, you sent me their stuff, the shoes with the teeth and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
And they had this great slogan, primeval yet contemporary, which is, I think, a great encapsulation of what we're talking about.
You know, I coined the term paleo-modern.
Well, that's also great.
And my mom's got t-shirts and hoodies.
That's what I'm talking about. Go, Mom!
And they're on special. They're on sale right now.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because people weren't buying them, so we lowered the price to clear them out of the garage.
Well, I'm going to buy one. Where do I find them?
ChrisRyanPhD.com.
Jesus.
Go to the store, and you'll see all the fascinating array of t-shirts for sale there.
Wow.
All made by Sure Design T-shirts in Thailand. Yeah, they're soft yet strong.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna get some of those.
Yeah.
I'll
give you some. I got a
pile
of them right over there. I don't think there are any paleo modern ones, but you can feel that soft.
Well, color. I'm gonna plug the shit out of that as well.
Don't you have? Did I ever give you a Civilized to Death shirt with the sad chimp? Oh, okay. Well, when we finish here, remind me. There's some there, yeah.
Wow.
Potential swag, depending on if we can find your size.
Oh, damn. Well, I don't know that they come in that size.
you have a special size?
I have a special purpose.
Yeah.
But you know, I think part of, you know, we've talked about this process of detribalizing.
Yeah.
And I think so much of the challenge for people in terms of detribalizing is that in practice, it often means going into exile because you leave whatever tribe you have and then you have no community. And then you have to sort of sort through that all on your own, which makes it particularly hard.
Yeah. If you're lucky, you find the community of people who are detribalized, which happen to be the most interesting people in the world, in my opinion. But it's not easy to find them because they don't all hang out in the same place.
And so that is
their nature.
And that is the goal. The goal is to basically create a community of people who have gone through detribalization.
Right.
And to then start to evolve deliberately and continue to be evolving a better and better culture. And so that's really the goal of Mixed Mental Arts. And, you know, you're one of the major deities within that.
Am I a mixed mental artist?
If you want to be, we'd be honored to have you.
Do I get like a gi or something?
You can have any of the swag you want. Mm. We can have a whole, you know, we can get real hunter-gatherer about this shit and, you know, have reciprocal altruism.
That'd be cool. Oh, yeah. That's a great idea. Instead of t-shirts or in addition to t-shirts, we should sell like civilized to death loincloths.
Oh, dude, I am in. We could gather around the fire. And listen, I'd actually like to go on a boar hunt.
Yeah. Well, Kyle says he can hook me up with these guys in Hawaii. And the other thing about the boar hunting in Hawaii is that, you know, he does this thing called Surfing for Change or Surf for Change. Mm-hmm. It's a YouTube channel that he does. He's a big wave surfer. He goes all around the world. Oh, awesome. But he does these videos about social things that are happening in different areas, mm-hmm. you know, not just the surf.
Right.
And so in Hawaii, and I encourage everybody who's listening to this, if you want to check it out, go to his, I think it's KyleTierman.surf something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Look him up on YouTube. He's got a channel.
Okay.
Anyway, so in Hawaii, the deal is that these pigs are feral. They were brought by Captain Cook or some, mm-hmm. you know, Westerner.
Wonderful human being like that.
Yeah. And they've gone totally crazy. And they have disrupted lots of native species. And they dig up the dirt so much. And then it rains and the dirt runs down and it kills the coral.
Right.
So it's not only fucking up the land, it's fucking up the sea.
Yep.
So you're doing them a favor by killing some of these pigs. They're, right. You know, it's a big problem. So it's not like, you know, going to Africa and killing a zebra or something. Right. Or I shouldn't say a lion. You know, zebras right. aren't. Zebras are interesting. You ever seen a zebra?
Like not up in close? Person, but I'm going to South
you
Africa.
You ever held
soon.
A baby zebra?
No, yeah, but I would held all the baby. I feel like after the Cabbage Patch doll, the zebra is the next step up.
Well, zebras are fascinating because they look like horses. You would think they're very much like horses, but they're impossible
to domesticate.
To domesticate. Yep. Yeah. There are some animals that just won't do it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And some people. You ever think about why did they ship? Why did they go to all the trouble of shipping all those Africans mm-hmm. to the New World as slaves? Why didn't they just enslave the Indians?
Well, one of the explanations that I heard from Charles C. Mann.
1491.
Yep.
Good book.
And 1493. And in 1493, he makes the case that it's all was about malaria.
Yeah. Well, and other infectious diseases as yeah, well, yeah. That the African.
And I actually found, I was Googling around, and I found there's some research that essentially the same thing happened around the oases in the Arabian Peninsula because there was so much malaria there. Mm. And so sub-Saharan African slaves started to predominate there because they also had malarial resistance.
Wow, yeah.
So it may be that, you know, these same environments, you know, selected for these same cultural outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. Where were we? Zebras. They won't
zebras,
be domesticated.
And why did they bring lots of Africans all the way across?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the disease is probably the major component. But the other thing that I've read repeatedly in accounts over the years is that the Native Americans just refused.
Yeah.
You know, they would rather die than be enslaved. And also, I guess, fear of death is an interesting thing, right? If your mm-hmm. fear of death is relatively low, then the list of things you refuse to do grows.
Right.
You ever read, there's a short story by Herman Melville, it's very interesting, called Bartleby the Scrivener?
I know of it, but I've never read it.
It's quite interesting, because I'd like to read it again. It's been a long time since I read it, but what I remember is the main character just basically refuses to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about detribalization and stuff. I remember the recurring line is he just says, I'd prefer not to. He just keeps saying, I'd prefer not to.
Yeah.
When he's told to do this or that. And so he just sort of separates himself. So I wonder what, you know, we often say, what if there's nothing you're willing to die for, then your life isn't worth living. You know, there are all those expressions. Are there things you would die for? Ideas or people or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously there are problems with our culture, but it is this massive human collaboration that has happened over so long, and I think that there are times when you know, humanity can go in very bad directions or very, you know, much more positive directions. And I think that if it comes down to it and your life has the ability to tip the balance one way or the other, that it's, you know, you're always, you know, your life is obviously your greatest resource, right? It's the most valuable thing you have. And so the question is, how can you best use that resource for the benefit of the tribe? And I think that really, it just becomes, comes down to
so
that.
So give me an example, though. How, what does that mean in concrete terms?
So, for example, if you, I think part of the, I think part of the challenge is that, A, you don't know what you would do until you're really put in that position. Right. Like, it's easy to, like, sit here and be like, you know, if I had the chance to, you know, shoot Hitler or whatever and die in the process, I would. But I, there are a lot of things that I'm willing to fight for, but I have a hard time understanding a situation in which you dying strengthens that fight.
Yeah.
Like, if you're no longer, or like, what is the situation in which, you know, I mean, there are certain military situations where potentially, yeah, you have to sacrifice your life to save others.
Suicide mission or jump on a grenade,
Or something like that.
I have a buddy who just gave up one of his kidneys to a childhood friend that he hadn't seen in 15 years.
Yep.
Well, that was, that, I mean, that's, you know, you're not dying, but you're
certainly
taking away
your life,
spare, you know,
I have a friend who did that as well, and he did it for more or less a total stranger. She was some sort of friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, and they happened to be a match.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where, you know, essentially they, you know, had some friend. They went, they haplotyped everybody, and then based on that, it was like he was a match, and he volunteered one of his kidneys, which is obviously a huge, huge thing. Now, that's the question is, if you'd given up one of your kidneys for Amy, how would things have gone? Do you think she would have just handed you lube, or would there be...
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to have to get back in touch with Amy.
And say, can I...
I got a new offer for you.
Throw a spare kidney, one slightly used kidney your
Thanks
way.
Thanks for the lube.
Let's see if I can, you know, switch the calculus on this.
See, I find that whole thing of like dying for your country or dying for this or that, I find that really problematic, because the older I get, the less comfortable I am feeling that I know what's right or what's wrong, what's good or what's bad, you know.
Well, I think it also gets to something that you've talked about a lot, which is that a lot of these sort of super organisms or super entities have a life of their own, have incentives of their own, and the nation state creates myths that serve it, you know, chews up individuals as and when it needs. You know, I mean, the myth that we've all been sold is the myth that World War II was the good war.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, for example, like in 2004, I just graduated from college and I actually went to a recruiting office to, because I was like, you know, I had literally no idea what to do. And so I went and I talked to, I think, somebody from the Air Force or whatever, or the Army. And, you know, I was sort of interested in doing linguistics. And then, you know, I talked to the guy and it became very clear that there was no guarantee that I would be sent to Monterey to study languages. And I was like, boom, so I may be signing up for what I think is one thing. And then you're going to use me wherever you think I'll be most necessary, which may be as cannon fodder.
Right.
So I think that's the big problem is that, I mean, people forget that the nation state is not old. It's only a few hundred years old. It really, I mean, you know, Germany was cobbled together 200 years ago.
Right.
Italy was cobbled together during the Risorgimento, which is even less. You know, French is actually Parisian that was just imposed on the country. You know, Spanish is the same thing. So these myths are very modern myths.
Yeah.
And I also don't think that most of these myths are going to survive for much longer anyway. I think the nation state
feels that way, doesn't it? Going back to city states or regional.
Well, I think
tribes.
You're going to see the emergence of, I think, you know, I had this conversation a few years ago with a friend of mine, Marie O'Reilly, and she works in sort of development and conflict resolution, all of that. And, you know, the way she describes it is human first, where people have a series of concentric circles of identity, but the real thing is to reach a place where people's core identity is human.
Right.
And then you have other affiliations.
Well, and like, this gets back to the detribalization thing, right? So as people drop away from these antiquated tribal identities, hopefully we find a more universal identity. So it's funny. So we start talking about my trip. We talked about one Amy. And and we veered off into lube and who knows what else. So the other person I interviewed in Santa Cruz was Jim Fadiman. You know, he is the microdosing kind of guru of microdosing LSD.
Yep.
And he's a fascinating guy, really cool guy. And then I went up to Mendocino and interviewed Tim Scully, who was an LSD cook in the 60s and 70s who made millions of hits of LSD and was trying to change the world. He was featured in a recent film called The Sunshine Makers.
Wow.
Yeah, really interesting cat. Got busted eventually, did... I think 3 years in prison. He was sentenced to 10, but he did 3.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was really interesting.
And so how did he think he was going to change the world by like detribalizing
turning people on, you know, see the truth, get it, you know, break your out of your mind forged manacles, as William Blake said. Yeah. So that was very interesting, you know, to talk to someone who was, you know, obviously a genius, like a really, really smart guy, definitely on the autism spectrum somewhere. He himself said that. And, you know, and yet whose life was motivated, like he gave his life. He knew he was going to get arrested and he didn't give a shit. He just kept pumping out LSD because he thought it was going to help humanity.
Well, I think this then gets down to, like, what do you mean by giving your life? Because if you mean giving your life in terms of devoting yourself and all of your energies to a cause, I'm doing that.
Or dying.
But I don't, not in the sense of, like, you know, I'm not looking to take a bullet.
I was thinking about this morning. There was a thing on the news about, you know, I don't remember, some congressman insulted... Trump's chief of staff, who's a general.
Right.
General somebody. And the people talking about it were all incensed in there. Like, what? This is a man who's given his 50 years in service to this country. And I thought, it's so funny. Like, people in the military get paid, right?
Yeah.
Like, they get a really good pension. They get health care. They get housing. They get, you know, in what sense are they giving anything to this nation? You know?
Well, some of them are in the line of fire, that's for sure.
Okay. But they're getting paid. I mean, it's a job.
It is a job. I think the thing that bothers me more about that is that there has been such a narrow definition of what patriotism is.
Yeah.
And that, you know, patriotism, like it's the thing that I always think is funny is that there's a reason why the Second Amendment is second. It's because it's your backup plan. You know, your first plan is if you're doing what you should be doing with speech and free assembly and all of that, then you don't have to get to the stage where you're using guns.
Right.
You should be able to resolve all of your differences by talking them out. And then, you know, but this what's ended up happening is that there's become this very narrow definition of patriotism, where patriotism is marked by are you in uniform or are you not?
Right.
And if you're in uniform, then you're a patriot and you're serving your country. And if you're not... then you're not really, and you're just sort of relying on them to save your ass again and again.
From what, Afghanistan?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's the stupid thing about the whole argument around terrorism is the fact that the whole point, and all credit for this goes to George Friedman, who's at Stratfor, the Strategic Analysis, and he's got a couple of great books, The Next 100 Years and The Next Decade.
Mm.
But the whole point he makes in there is that the nature of terrorists is that they are weak and they are unable to pose an existential threat. So at no point could Al-Qaeda capture and hold Milwaukee. They didn't have the forces or the ability to do that. They didn't even have really their own weapons. They had to take our own planes and turn them into weapons. And so the only thing that that a power that is that weak can do is to rely on emotion and to create so much fear and so much panic that the giant stumbles. And that's what they did. They, you know, they were the gnat, the gadfly, that made us so emotional that we were drawn into a war in Afghanistan and a war in Iraq that, you know, financially crippled us, killed lots of people, destroyed all the goodwill that we had. I mean, you think about where the United States was post-Cold War. You know, we've never had more soft power than we did after the Cold War. Maybe after World War II as well. But and then, you know, and all the financial resources, and then, you know, piss that all away.
Well, but we didn't piss it away. We transferred it to arms merchants, right? And so I think there's a huge sort of momentum toward keeping wars running because it, you know, it feeds that beast. And if you, if the beast isn't getting enough, it starts to turn on itself.
Yeah, the military-industrial complex Eisenhower warned about.
Exactly, yeah. So I don't, I look at that and I think, certainly it was a mistake, and, you know, from my perspective, it was a huge mistake. But I think it's, to me, it's more complicated than a mistake. It's almost predictable, you know. It's almost like they're looking. There are powers that are always looking for a reason to throw a bunch of money into more wars, you know.
And it doesn't. And I think the other thing too is just it's the echo chamber of the military-industrial complex,
right?
Where if you're constantly surrounded by the idea that there are all these threats and the narrative that there are people who are out to get us, then that becomes all of your thinking. It's just an echo chamber. But I think that there are, that's you ultimately, a lot of this comes down to waking people enough up that they're willing to question the narratives that they're being fed. And I think that part of what the internet is going to enable and make possible, and already has made possible to a large extent, is that you're being exposed to so many counter narratives and so many other ways of thinking that essentially no one narrative becomes necessarily the dominant narrative. So if you think about the 1950s, in the 1950s, you're all hearing the dangers of communism, the danger of communism, which is why someone like McCarthy can get so out of control.
Right.
And then ultimately it takes a small number of people in the media like Edward R. Murrow who are willing to provide the counter narratives.
Right.
But in
when allowed to by their corporate overlords,
of course.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you know, you can go and you can listen to lots and lots of other narratives
if you want to.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you can also do, you know, go the other direction, which the internet and, you know, media explosion is also allowing, which is just go into your hole and just listen to people who agree with you. But so what do you think? I just wrote a piece for the introduction to this podcast book that we're putting together with some excerpts from the first couple of couple hundred episodes. And, you know, I compared podcasting to the advent of the printing press, which you mentioned earlier. And, you know, maybe it's hyperbole, who knows, but it seems to me that the ultimate impact of podcasting could be comparable to the printing press.
So this is funny because yesterday I did a podcast with Brian and Thaddeus Russell. And
did he fly down for it?
He was in town.
He was in town.
He flew down on his broomstick.
Nice.
But he literally used the Reformation analogy. And I, for the last 6 to 8 months or however long, or a year or something, have been saying that we need a scientific reformation. So I think that is absolutely where we are. And the analogy is the same because there were people like Jan Hus and lots and lots of other people who challenged the Catholic Church. But they were all silenced because, you know, it was easy to just execute them, or, you know, John Wycliffe was another one. And their movements never took off. the advantage that that Martin Luther had was that he was nearby a town that had a printing press.
Pamphlets.
And within a few years, they'd flooded Europe with 3 million pamphlets.
3 million?
Three million.
No shit.
And so it's the same thing, is that you and I get to have these conversations. So for so long in the 1950s, you know, academia, there was this unholy alliance between academia and the media of who was legitimate and whose voice counted.
Right.
And now, and this is literally the conversation that I had with Thaddeus and Brian, is that, you know, Thaddeus was like, there are all these podcasts, and, you know, if you look at them, the top ones are all like NPR, blah, 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 and they're just doing what radio has done, and they're boring. And then you get to this other chunk of podcasts, which is Joe Rogan, you know, The Fighter and the Kid, Thaddeus, you know, you, Mixed Mental Arts, you know, Tangentially Speaking, all of this stuff. And that is where the intellectual reformation is coming from.
Mm.
And the pieces are already there. And really, we just need to connect the dots, organize, help people detribalize, provide them with a space where they can do that, and then provide such a coherent, clear alternative that it becomes clear side-by-side test. There's what the universities are producing in terms of an education, in terms of students, in terms of preparation for the world, in terms of their view of the world. And, you know, the analogy that I heard from Jenny Aguilar, who I mentioned earlier, apparently in birthing, there's some book, I can't remember the name of the book, but the author talks about how there is the medical myth and then the research reality.
Mm.
And that the two do not match up with each other, and people naively do. And it's a perfect description for what's going on. You call it the standard narrative.
Yeah.
And, you know, in education, it's the same thing. There's the educational myth, and then there's the research reality. And the problem is that these myths are not a good fit for reality.
Yeah.
Because those myths are not a good fit for reality, they create all these problems for people in their lives.
Right.
And the only reason why we buy into them is because of intuitions of authority, where, you know, we've been told that the doctors know what they're talking about and that they're the authority and they're the experts. And now you have the ability where we can put these ideas out there, we can expose them to people, and people can choose to go where they want. They can listen to whoever they want. They can form their own conclusion.
So, okay, now you seem to be operating under the assumption, and I think I share this assumption, but let's examine it. The assumption is that this multiplicity of options, multiplicity of voices, opinions, arguments, and so on, is going to lead to superior outcome.
Yeah.
Whereas there is an argument to be made, I think, that it leads to just further fractious tribalization. You get more Alex Joneses, you get Bill O'Reilly, you get people who are unchecked by any sort of community voice.
So I think that, you know, this is, I mean, Joe Rogan has said that, you know, the internet is in its adolescence. And I think that's a perfect analogy for where it is. You know, this is sort of the pre-Cambrian explosion. There's like all sorts of shit going on.
So is it going to be meet the new boss same as the old boss? In other words, is the adulthood of the internet going to be corporate control once again? No? How are we going to...
Well, I think... I don't know about the corporate control part. Here's the part that I... There's a few things that I feel pretty good about. So in the big problem, I think, is, you know, the big problem of the Catholic Church is that it's about human authority, right? And that the Pope says, therefore the Pope goes, and this sort of infallible individual.
Mm.
And then the Protestants are sort of say, we're going to read this stuff and we're going to decide for ourselves. And then in the same way with science, there are popes, and there are these people, and they speak ex cathedra, and they are the authorities, and what we say goes. And I think that essentially, you know, there's been a massive rebellion against experts in 2016, mostly against essentially economists. But there are all these other people like Brett of the School Sucks podcast, School Sucks Project.
Mm.
So he's very much the same thing as the straight A conspiracy, just all the ways in which school is not set up for human beings. It's not set up for human biology and doesn't support them. So all these...
Yeah, isn't that funny? All this research now coming out just in the last week showing that extended sitting is the greatest predictor of premature death. Mm-hmm. And what is school? Sit down.
Yep.
Kids, sit down. Sit down.
Also, by the way, what is this? What is humanity's superpower? Like, what separates us out from all the other apes? Social
play.
Intelligence.
Yeah.
And play. And then what are you trying to punish and shut down?
Right.
Socialization and play.
Exactly.
So you've literally, it's an environment that is designed to make children dumber.
It's compliant.
Yeah, compliant.
Yeah.
And that's the you know, I mean, that's the thing, is that's what served the industrial age.
That's true.
Was people who would follow orders.
Yeah, I don't know if I've told you this story, and I was talking one time with this guy. I think he was Australian. I was on the road somewhere, and I said something about, people are just stupid like sheep, you know. And he said, I grew up on a sheep farm, actually. Sheep aren't stupid. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, what happens is, when a sheep shows you some sign of intelligence by getting his nose under the fence or figuring out how to jump over, you know, this barrier or whatever, you kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, the other ones will follow him.
Yep.
So sheep aren't dumb. They're not dumber than any other animal. But because of the needs of social control, we eliminate the ones that show any
smart
sign
ones,
of intelligence. Yep. So it's what you say. It's like schooling. Yeah, it's the opposite of cultivating intelligence.
Yep.
It's the opposite of what it actually claims to be.
Yeah, of course.
It's so hard, though, man, because you get these teachers who are... I mean, I taught. Did I ever tell you I taught high school for... Oh, God, it was terrible. I did... It was the... So what happened was I saw this movie called Pay It Forward, Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
And... I was reminded of all these great teachers I had when I was a kid who, you know, I moved a lot. I was always the new kid. And so there were these teachers who recognized that I was in a tough spot. I didn't know anyone. And they would go out of their way to make me comfortable. And, hey, come by after class if you want to talk. And they just really good people, you know, and recognized my little drama. And I have a lot of gratitude toward them. And so I saw that movie and... I was thinking about, you know, how lucky I was that those people were kind to me and all that. And then I saw an ad for a local private school in Barcelona for mainly for foreigners and rich Spanish people. And they were looking for a history teacher. And this was like August. And the school started like 2 weeks later.
Right.
And so I went, I was like, eh, fuck it, I could do that. Why not? I was working on my dissertation. My schedule was pretty flexible. And I went in, and I figured they wouldn't hire me anyway because I didn't have any degree in history. I had a degree in English, right?
Right.
But they were like, you're in a PhD program? You're a native English speaker? You know, like,
this
fuck yeah, you're the guy. And they were desperate, right? So they hired me. And I was supposed to teach American history from the Civil War till now. So, and I had two classes and they were both 10th graders, I think, 10th or 11th graders. They were 16, 17. And the first week of school, 9/11 happened. So it was like the second class was after 9/11, right? So I was just like, okay, listen, forget about the Civil War. We're going to talk about American foreign policy. We're going to talk about oil, you know, the Treaty of Yalta, you know, the whole Middle East thing, because you guys will remember this the rest of your lives. Trust me. So we're going to talk about why this happened, the context of that, right? And so we did for, we probably did that for a month or two. And the thing is, within a week or two, I realized that this had been a giant mistake on my part, that these kids didn't want to fucking listen to me, you know?
Right.
Of the 25 kids in the class, there were probably 5 to 10 who were into it. They were smart, they were mature, they were interested. The rest were just like, you know, goofball idiots.
Yeah.
And not that they were stupid, but they were young primates, and all they wanted to do was flirt and joke and run around. And it got to the point where I just said, like, look, if you don't want to be here, please don't come.
Yeah.
Like, I won't tell anyone. I don't give a shit. Just don't come here.
Right.
Like, we have to come here. If they see us.
Yeah.
Like, well, can't you just, like, sit back there? You know, they're just.
Yeah.
So it was very frustrating because if I could have just hung out with them.
Right.
and not been some sort of enforcer,
right,
it would have been great. But and I didn't enforce, so it just collapsed into chaos.
But to see, I think that's the key thing is that I don't think, again, it's not that there are bad teachers, that the teacher people, there are bad teachers, but teachers who do a bad job.
Yeah.
But there aren't, I don't think that teachers are bad people in the sense that there
no,
are.
No, it's a hopeless situation.
And there's the demands of the institution.
Yeah.
And the institution doesn't, like, it just all comes down to it's not designed for humans as they are.
Well, that's the thing. If you're a good person, as a lot of teachers are, you find yourself in a position where you're acting against the interests of the people you're trying to help.
Yeah, and against your own inclinations.
Right.
Because, I mean, so much of it is there becomes this curriculum. And, you know, the number of times that you're working with a student and you're like, oh, like I was working with this kid the other day and she had, you know, terrible experience at school, right? And so now I'm helping her through homeschool just to sort of like give her a reboot so she can get on track, so she can get back into school and have a better thing.
Right.
And this girl could not be more curious.
Right.
She has a million questions.
That's great.
She's asking about, you know, Christianity and Catholicism and like why we have this and why we have that. And then sitting in front of us is the curriculum. And there's like a whole bunch of like little milestones and assignments that have to be jumped through.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it just becomes that tension between like what's good for your education is that we just keep talking and we just explore every question you have.
Right.
And we would do that for however long, a few
sort of
months,
a Socratic,
3 months,
Socratic
6 months,
system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then at the end of those 6 months, you would know whatever you know. And then, you know, we could probably still then work through all that year's worth of material in 6 months, no problem, satisfy the milestones. But the point is that that's not the way the schedule works.
Yeah.
And that's not what the parents expect, because the parents have cultural expectations of school is about like completing assignments every day. So you end up having this tension between what you want to do, what the kid wants to do, what serves the kid in the long run, and then the dictates of the institution of like you have to fulfill the milestones.
I was really lucky in the sense that as soon as because I moved a lot in high school, I didn't do very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got my SAT scores were high, but my grades weren't. And so I ended up going to, sort of the normal track would have been Ivy League and you know, all that. But because my grades sucked and I didn't give a shit because I was just dealing with social stuff, I ended up going to this school, Hobart College in upstate New York, which was, I didn't know at the time, but it was sort of unique because in the 60s, it was a hotbed of radical student agitation. Somebody bombed the ROTC building and, you know, whatever. So in the 60s, it was like, whoa, crazy, you know, kind of a Kent State situation. Yep. So a lot of the people who were teaching there had been radicals in the 60s. And they're like, oh, fuck yeah, Hobart, you know.
Yeah.
And Hobart, when I first got there, they had this grading system, which was ABC/. There were no Ds or Fs. And so if you got a slash, what that meant was you just never took that course.
Which is great.
It was great. It was so as to encourage you to try new things and not worry about it. If it doesn't work out, it's not going to affect your GPA.
Right.
And you could have, I think freshman year, you could have 2 slashes, and then it was maybe 1 per year after that or something. I don't remember. So it was this sort of radical, like very cool, hip faculty.
Right.
But the problem is that it's a private college, so it's very expensive.
Right.
So the student body was a bunch of fucking right-wing George Bush, you know, Ronald Reagan supporting golf club types. So I got there and I was like very aligned with the faculty and not with the students. And so the faculty were like, oh, this guy's like us.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting essentially like a, you know, tutorial education. I became friends with professors and they just like, you know, hey, let's go to New York for the weekend. We'll see some films and go to museums and we'd walk around, get high, and they'd tell me, my friend Eric especially would be like, yeah, so this is, you know, the famous thing where the women were locked in the building and they had jumped out of the windows when the building caught on fire.
It was
in the village somewhere.
Yeah. It was a textile plant.
Yeah, and it was sort of the beginning of labor rights movement. So I got this private education from these people. You know, and Andrew Harvey, who was the youngest person to ever teach at Oxford, was one of my friends. And, you know, just like fantastic. But who gets that, you know?
But see, the interesting thing, if we go, because, you know, I think probably especially because of you, you know, I went through my own education, then I read all the neuroscience and the psych, and then, you know, I've sort of realized all the problems with that, and then increasingly, I've been thinking about how hunter-gatherers educate.
Mm.
And it is that you are in awe of someone. You see that they have something that you want. You spend time around them. You start dressing and acting like them. You know, they start to show you things. And it is all done socially and through relationships.
Right.
And there's no reason why we can't have that.
Well, can we, though? Isn't it a question of scale, like everything else?
But I think the interesting thing is, and this is, so I've been having these conversations recently as well, is let's think about old people and young people.
Yeah.
Right? And old people have skills, but very often what they don't have is a sense of purpose, right? They've retired, they are a little bit lost, and there's a real danger of old people sort of atrophying and, you know, just sort of giving up.
Yeah.
Young people are badly in need of knowledge because they don't have a lot of that yet. They don't have a lot of that wisdom and that insight. And, you know, so the point is that if you take an old person and a young person, you put them together, you solve both people's problems and you create a win-win.
There's a cool place in Holland
where
they do that.
That's exactly right.
You know about that place, So young people get free housing in the old folks' home and they spend a couple hours a week or whatever it is hanging out and it's good. It's a win-win. I would counter, though, by saying that something... There's an essential difference between the hunter-gatherer world and the world that we live in that makes this model very difficult, which is that hunter-gatherer kids are growing up in the same world that their older people grew up in.
Yep.
So if I teach you how to use a blowgun and shoot monkeys, it's the same thing I learned. Whereas old people... skills they have aren't relevant to this world.
Well, some of them aren't.
A lot of them, yeah.
Some of them are. Not all of them, but some of them, you know, I mean, the emotional and the relationship skills are probably pretty timeless.
And knowledge and how people act and, you know. Yeah, knowledge is important. But when you said skills, that sort of jumped out at me because I've just been writing about this, how hunter-gatherers are at ease in their world because that's the world that created them.
Yeah.
That's the world. It's like a cactus in the desert. That's exactly where it's supposed to be. That's why it's shaped like a cactus, right? Whereas we're living, every generation of us is living in a world that has never existed before.
Yep.
And
and even within the decade.
Fucking crazy.
Well, and no, even
yeah,
within the decade.
Even, yeah.
I mean, you know,
did you read this sorry to interrupt you, Atlantic article about the generation, the first generation that's grown up with smartphones?
Oh, yeah, and how they...
They're fucked up.
Yeah, how it's fucked them.
Like, on every measure.
Yeah.
They're socially inept, they're suicidal, they're depressed, they're unhealthy. It's just like...
Yep.
That's progress.
Well, but I think that's the... that is where I think there's a couple of things. That's where the primeval yet contemporary thing comes in.
Yeah.
It may be that, you know.
Paleo-modern, bitches.
Paleo-modern. And that's really what it's got to be about. And then I think the other thing, too, is with the skills transfer, I think part of it is that it may be much more two-way, where also the young people are teaching the old people how to, you know, handle and manage technology.
Right. To get their email.
Well, I mean, it's the classic thing of, like, junior helps grandma learn how to check her AOL.
Yeah.
Now, the little man didn't come up yet. Why is that? And then I think the other thing, too, is that in an environment that is constantly changing, you need a constantly evolving culture and a constantly evolving set of mental tools.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it really is about embracing constant learning.
God, wouldn't it
And
be nice to live in a world where you could just learn and have it all figured out by 40 and then just coast the rest of the way?
would it though?
Well, you know, I think again we're breaking it down into I mean, obviously I'm kidding to some extent, but breaking it down into skills versus knowledge.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like, how old are you?
36.
Yeah. So I didn't feel it at 36, but I somewhere in my mid 40s, I think I started to feel like, oh, I see how this works. You know, like on a lot of different levels, dealing with women, dealing with money, dealing with loss, you know, there's just sort of an acceptance and a sense of arrival. Yeah, so there is a feeling as I'm 55 now, and there's a feeling as I get older that it's like, yeah, it's funny how it's set up like you finally learn to dance just when the party's almost over. You know, it's just, and it so it sometimes makes me think, yeah, it would be nice if I'd like learn if I'd figured this shit out in my 20s. Because I can, but it's funny because it's an eternal conundrum. I can remember Andrew Harvey, this guy I mentioned earlier. This guy's the youngest person to ever be a don at Oxford, right? He was W.H. Auden's lover when Auden died. People don't know Auden. He was the poet laureate of
Yeah,
England, I
one of the
think.
greatest poets of all time,
Yeah,
really.
yeah. Great guy. I mean, I never met Auden, obviously, but brilliant. Yeah, and Andrew was 21. He was a full Oxford at dawn. He's, you know, he's from the family, the Harvey family of discovering the circulation of the blood.
Oh,
Indira Gandhi was
Jesus.
his godmother. So he's from this amazing
Wow.
family.
Yeah.
And I can remember hanging out with him and talking about the future and whatever. And I can remember him saying, oh, if I had figured out things as well as you have at your age, God knows where I'd be now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, right,
Yeah, you're the
dude.
youngest Don at Oxford, dude.
Yeah, right.
But I think, you know, I mean, I think that's also the interesting thing, and I hadn't really thought about it until now, but although we live in this environment of constant change because of human biology and just because of, you know, there are certain things that are going to be more or less constant.
Well, human nature,
Yeah.
you know, human nature hasn't changed, I think, you know, for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
I think we're agitated and we're living in under much more stress. And so that changes the sort of chemical reactions that happen, just like, you know, if you increase the pressure on different chemicals, they'll react to one another differently than they would at sea level under normal atmospheric pressure. But yeah, I think if you remove those external constraints, I think human nature, you know, we want the same things. You know, we want to be loved, we want to have pleasure, we want to be healthy, and you know, we want a certain amount of movement, a certain amount of rest. You get back to the big five there.
Big six, dude.
What was the sixth one?
I think childbirth was probably
Yeah, but that only
that's a
applies to
subset
some
of,
women,
or you make that just sort of like a subcodicil
or
on
maybe like
fucking
or birth death. I would,
birth death,
you
or you
know,
make it there.
yeah, I would put it there
Yeah.
maybe. Yeah, codicil, nice word,
Well, now that
nice.
I know that you're a
Are
word
you
Nazi,
lecking? There are no women
yeah,
around
I'm
here,
lucking
man.
for
Don't
you,
lek
dude.
for me.
Yeah,
You're
why shouldn't I luck for Uncle Cress?
lekking up the wrong tree
That,
there,
by the way,
buddy.
sounds like an amazing, you know, riff on, like, instead of "Don't cry for me, Argentina," "Don't lek for Uncle Cress."
Yeah. The big five, I like that. Yeah, maybe I'll reorganize Civilized to Death around the big five. I'm constantly reshuffling it. I've reshuffled it so many times now, I don't know even where I am.
I think the Big Five is really good because the Big Five is really where it becomes clear that civilization is what's killing you. Like
Right,
it is
exactly.
this culture that is not paleo modern
Yeah.
that is fucking you up. Yeah. So the big five is a really primal way to do it.
Yeah, they're touchstones. They're things everyone understands, although I don't know writing an entire chapter about shitting.
Oh, I actually, that's the one I'm most excited for.
Yeah. Well, I have, you know, I did in the original proposal for this book that I turned in 5 years ago or something, there is a chapter on shitting. And I've done some research, and I met a woman who wrote a book about shitting, too. I forget where it is, but... Yeah, I mean, the squatty toilet. Yeah, I've got one.
Yeah, I've got a squatty potty too. And, and you know, I mean, that's the thing. That's why I am a big fan of the idea of coming out of the water closet. I think the more of us that come out of the water closet and admit that we use the squatty potty, the more it's going to be like, oh man, my culture has literally been fucking me up the ass for quite some time now. And I am so much better off instead of sitting while
shitting.
I'm going
to steal that.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, the you know, in my apartment in Barcelona, I have an Asian toilet.
Which is the dream.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even want the Western toilet with the add-on.
It's not the same.
It's
having
not
your
same.
Feet up is not the same as squatting.
No, it's a whole other thing. You just, the hips settle in much more.
I did a podcast the other day with a supermodel, like legit supermodel. You ever see that the Super Bowl, the famous Super Bowl ad for Carl's Jr. with the really hot woman? Like eating a burger and it's like
dripping
on her chin.
Yeah.
That's her. Yeah,
okay, good for her.
Yeah. And we spent most of the time talking about shitting and farting.
That is what I'm talking about.
It's like, I do it all the time because I agree with you. I mean, it's like, bring that stuff out, talk about, you know, animality. I think, and this gets back to the big five and it gets back to these points we were making. I think most of the problems people have psychologically and physically are due to their loss of relationship with their animality.
100%.
Yeah.
And it's the denial that we are animals.
Right.
And
I still read this all the time. Like, you know, we evolved from ape-like creatures.
Yeah.
No, fuck you. We are ape-like creatures.
Yeah. Or we are just apes.
We're apes. We're very ape-like. Yeah.
We're the socially intelligent ape.
Just the language of that.
Of course.
That we evolved from apes.
Yeah.
To what?
Well, but it is this, that it's always like the thing that drives me nuts is that it's this idea of the break in history.
Yeah.
That's what drives me nuts. Even with the Enlightenment, always there's this narrative that sounds like the narrative of every religion, where it's like there were the Dark Ages.
Right.
And so we just make the era before us shittier to seem as bad as possible. And then there's the Enlightenment.
Thomas Hobbes, there it
is. Yeah, and then you have the Enlightenment, and it's like, oh, and then everything was so much better. And why do we have the Enlightenment? Well, because we'd figured out the secret sauce, and the secret sauce was reason, you know.
And the chosen ones.
And the chosen
ones. Who were us.
The great white gods.
Isn't that great how that worked out?
Yeah.
It's us.
But I think 100%, I think so much of how you're going to detribalize people and start to create a tribe called human and with this human first identity is the big five, because it becomes so primal and it's such a good test, because there are going to be people who are willing to talk about shit.
Right.
And there will be people who think that's beneath them and refuse to.
You,
and they will reveal their psychology because they're so uncomfortable with their own bodily functions.
Exactly. Like homophobes who are afraid to talk about homosexuality.
Yeah.
Like, hey, there's the giveaway.
And it's also...
You hate fags.
It's the biggest giveaway of authoritarianism as well, because the whole point is that so much of what that sort of sense of I'm separate from you relies on, it relies on this awe. And nothing destroys awe like shit.
Mm.
Shit is the thing. Like, if you see, whoever people are in awe of, if you see that person shitting on the toilet, that
Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah, gone.
Does he use a normal toilet, do you think? Or does he have, like,
a large capacity? He has a super duper toilet. Actually, by the way, there's a book by Mary Roach. Mary Roach writes all these
I've had her on this podcast.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
She's awesome. I'd
She's
love
great.
To get her on Mixed Mental Arts.
Yeah.
She writes
Gulp.
Gulp, exactly.
And they're all one-word titles.
Gulp, stiff, grunt,
right.
Bonk.
Bonk, that's the sex one where she has sex. She and her husband have sex in a CAT scanner or something.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
That is a really, you know, that is a husband who is up for anything. Good for him. Good for Mary.
Yeah.
But she talks in Gulp about megacolons.
Oh.
Yeah, and apparently Elvis had a megacolon.
Oh, really? And he
Yeah.
died on the
Toilet.
toilet.
And she thinks that's why he died on the toilet, or some people do, including Elvis's doctor. Because what happens is that when you're on the toilet and you're forcing it, you do the Valsalva maneuver. And because of the way that you're holding your breath, you actually make your heart stop for a second. And sometimes they don't restart. And so this is actually a big thing, is that a lot of people die on the toilet. And there's even.
Oh, I thought it was the pressure, like, popped an aorta or something.
No. It's something to do with cardiac function.
And on an Asian toilet, you never push. You just like
Exactly. It
relax
just
and
let it
let it
flow.
fall. Yeah.
Let it flow. Let it
Flow.
flow.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it
That's
is.
so beautiful. Did you know there's a sh their turd chart?
Oh, yeah, the
The
Bristol
Bristol
Stool Scale.
Stool.
Big fan of the Bristol Stool Scale. I
I've.
always categorize my shits after I take them.
Do you?
Yeah, just to brush up those skills, because you don't want those Bristol Stool Scales to atrophy. You've got to like keep them sharp. How quickly can you eyeball a four versus a five?
Well, let's see. The five is smooth like a snake, and the four is lumpy with cracks in it, but they're both acceptable. The four and five, yeah.
I had a
Or is it a three and a four? I forget. It's in the middle of the scale
All
there.
I know
I just looked
is
at it today, actually.
really.
Yeah, a friend sent it to me. It came up at dinner last night, and I was laughing. Like, why? Why Bristol? And she's like, I was like, you should make posters for bathrooms. And she's like, no, they exist. And she sent me one today.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But
So there's like the pellets. The one is the pellet, like
yeah, that's
hard
bad.
pellets, like rabbit shit. Like you're super constipated. And two is like larger but still hurts.
Yeah, well, and it's if you can see the bumps on it, I think.
Well, no, that's okay, because three is kind of like a log that's got bumps on it and cracks, and that's cool. And then four is smooth, still log-like, and that's cool. And then you're getting into like
Diarrhea.
mushy.
Yeah.
There's a stage before six is diarrhea. Five is like
And
somewhat
seven is
mushy.
just fire hydrant.
Seven is get out of Mexico.
Exactly. But
The Aztec two-step.
yeah, and there should really be a zero. And the zero
It's like,
is,
can't shit.
yeah, which is like apparently Elvis's mother used to have to manually disimpact him.
Oh,
That was literally
manually
disimpact
disimpacked.
him, and that's why he was so close to his mother.
Elvis's
Mother?
mother?
Yeah. This is what Mary Roach says in Gull. At least this is these are, it's all like rumors.
Jesus,
None of it's
and there, so
confirmed.
there he is, like the sexiest, coolest dude in the world,
And
and
his
his
mother
mother
is
had to stick her
manually
finger up his
disimpact.
ass, and oh man.
Man.
So yeah, so I'm talking with this fashion model the other day, and her name's Charlotte McKinney, and I don't know if I do it on purpose or what, but I got it because I lived with these models in Spain, and we're talking about how models, because they have so much attention to their physicality, they get really uptight about it, and it's a dangerous, toxic
Profession, yeah.
environment. But yeah, we talked. I asked her if she farted in front of men and stuff, and I say, like, for me, a woman's connection with her animality is like the number one thing I'm looking for with women. And the way I've expressed it is like a woman who's comfortable taking a dump behind a bush,
Yeah.
that's a girl for me.
Right.
A woman who's like, no, I need to go to a cafe. I need like, yeah, we're not gonna last very long because like. That doesn't work for me.
Well, if you're not comfortable with some part of your animality, you're probably not comfortable with other parts of
That's
it.
it. It's a package
Yeah.
deal. So if you're not comfortable with, admitting that you shit, then you're not going to sleep well. You probably aren't having orgasms. There's just a million things that are going to go wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, talking with you, it becomes clear. And I've always known this, but it's sort of thank you, Hunter. You're clarifying the purpose of my existence.
That's good.
But like, really, that's sort of the central theme in my life is like, let's admit we're animals.
And I mean, Isaiah Gulley, who I mentioned 1,000 times on our last podcast, and I'm going to limit myself to once on this one. But you know, he was very clear. The whole part of where the whole Chris Ryanism thing evolved from was
right.
him basically saying that, you know, what we were doing with mixed mental arts had really you had been doing for a long time, which is basically saying it's okay to be human.
Right.
And part of the it's okay to be human is it's okay to be an animal.
Right.
And
it's a different kind of animal than you've been told.
Right.
That's a part of it, you know, because people are told that we're this horrible, ferocious,
yep.
murderous beast. And so that's part of the thing. It's okay to be an animal, but you're not the kind of animal that they've been telling you
yeah.
are, which is why it's okay.
Right.
You know, it's a double message there. I just saw this again the other day. This drives me crazy, but I guess it's the nature of the beast. But, you know, is the Richard Wrangham, the Harvard
guy, the primatologist
guy. He wrote Catching Fire, and
yep.
he's been around a long time. He's done a lot of really good work. But there was this BBC thing, and it was about the primate origins of human murderousness.
Yeah.
And it was this thing with the chimps, and the chimps go off and patrol their zone, and they, you know, they're trying to catch and murder and ambush another. And there's no context. There's no
right.
discussion of how many times has this actually been seen?
Mm-hmm.
And how many, you know, chimp troops has this never been seen in decades of observation? You know, how, and why is there no discussion of bonobos? It's
mm-hmm.
just like, I don't understand how this shit keeps getting presented as science. It's unbelievable.
But that's, I mean, this sort of gets down to a much larger point about storytelling. And, you know, you talked about, like, even the seal and the shark attack.
Right.
And that, you know, it's disaster porn. That's what most of television is
right.
going for. They're going
right.
for the most emotionally immediate experiences.
But not only television, right? I
yeah.
mean, look at about evolutionary theory.
100%.
I know we've talked about that. It's they're calling it science, whether it's presented on TV or in books or magazines. They're calling it science, but it's totally acontextual.
Yep.
Totally cherry-picked, and they're only picking the bloody cherries.
Well,
yeah, Richard Dawkins goes nuts on that.
Well, he does, and that's why he gets so much attention.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, he basically makes Jaws. That's what he's doing,
yeah,
you know? It's
yeah.
the most dramatic, the most violent, the most extreme, the most, you know, all of that, and it's not the full picture. And what you need is you ultimately need, I mean, this is also the same thing with... you know, we had this guy, Adam Hansen, on the podcast the other day, who is an innovation expert. Like, that's what he does. He studies innovation. And, you know, he was talking about how, I mean, there's a couple of things that I think are important. One, if you ask like 4 or 5 year olds how many of you are creative, they all put their hands up. By the time you get to middle school and high school, there's maybe 1 or 2 kids that have put their hands up. So, A, that is trained out of people's natural inclinations to be creative and to explore and to do all of that.
Crazy.
And then the other thing, too, is he came up with this because he wrote a book called How to Outsmart Your Instincts.
Is creativity one of the big 6? If so, it's going to be big 7 now.
Oh, Jesus.
Because play.
Play.
Right?
I think play.
All
is...
primates play.
Yep.
I'm taking notes here.
Yep.
So we're now up to 7?
Well, let's see.
So we have play, sleep,
shitting, fucking,
fuck, eat,
birth, death.
Right. We're going to put those together. And
you got play. So
that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I feel like we're missing one. Yeah.
Yeah,
it'll come up.
Was eating's already in there?
Eat's in there.
Sleep,
fuck, shit. Well, we can. Our listeners are shouting out.
Yeah, exactly.
I know what it is. I know what it is. You can call us now.
Yeah,
1-800. So anyway,
so
I interrupted you.
So anyway, he wrote this
innovation,
book called,
right?
Yeah, Outsmart Your Instincts.
Right.
Which is all just about understanding our cognitive biases, so you can then work around them.
Right.
And you know he. Basically, the combination of the sort of the availability heuristic and the Dunbar number leads to what he calls dumbarring, which is where, you know, you see ISIS and they're so emotionally relevant and extreme. And if you have no other experience to Arabs or Muslims, then what happens is that, you know, you fill in and create the story about Arabs and Muslims that they're all basically like ISIS.
Right.
And it's the same thing with, you know, what is happens with a lot of this, you know, sort of disaster porn science, or what I call weird science, because it is that culture of the weirds, Western educated, industrialized, rich and democratic.
Yeah.
Where they just tell such a small piece of the story, and then people, because they hear none of the other parts of the story, they fill in and they think that's the whole story.
Well, and you can't blame them because they're being told it's the whole story,
yeah.
Right? I mean, in terms of evolutionary theory, the focus on competition, mm-hmm. you know, ruthless, eat
red
or be
and
eaten,
tooth and claw.
Right. That is being presented as the story.
Yep.
Darwin himself wouldn't agree with that.
Nope.
But
nor
unfortunately,
would David Sloan Wilson.
He's not here to defend himself. Yeah, look, Sloan Wilson is. But, you know, they're ridiculed. Those guys yep. have a real hard time getting heard at all.
But see, that's where this podcast community becomes so interesting. Mm. Because now you have a community of people who are essentially seekers, who are, many of them already are detribalized in some ways.
Yeah.
And they are, you know the problems of the standard narratives, of the standard culture, and you can build a coherent alternative. And so much of this comes down to numbers. When you have, you know, whatever this... I mean, you know, Thaddeus used, I think, the appropriate word here. You have this ecosystem. And when this ecosystem of, say, 30 million people, or however many it is, gets really comfortable with all these ideas, they know about David Sloan Wilson, they know about Joe Henrich, they know about Sex at Dawn, they know about John Haidt, they know about all of these different pieces, they know that that's what Darwin never believed himself, then at that point, there's now... instead of it just being that there's, you know, it's like tiny, those tiny little dissenting voices within academia and these big public voices, there's now two giants.
Hmm.
And now we have to resolve this dispute between these two giants.
Right.
And how is that dispute going to be resolved? It's going to be resolved based on, well, this is where it gets interesting. Is it resolved based on the social power of the two groups, or right. is it resolved on... who has the most compelling argument in terms
which
of the evidence.
Which gets back to the first thing we talked about mm-hmm. with the grammar Nazis.
Yep.
Is it right because more people believe it, or is it right because it's right?
Yep.
Yeah. Just so people, we're not leaving people behind here. David Sloan Wilson is a contemporary scientist, evolutionary scientist, who is one of a bunch of scientists. He and E.O. Wilson are the most mm-hmm. Well-known, arguing for what they call multi-level selection, which is a more nuanced and complex vision of how evolution proceeds than the selfish gene or the sort of cartoonish vision of, you know, everybody fighting and the survival
yep.
of the fittest and all that.
And there are two big parts. One, Dawkins' narrative is gene-centric. So it's myopically focused on genes at the expense of all else.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Wilsons are talking about it happening at every level. So it's genes, it's culture, it's tribes, it's groups. And then it's this very interesting thing of culture-gene coevolution.
Right.
Where, you know, you have, now obviously, and it becomes like when you look at the evidence... it's pretty obvious that the evidence is on the side of multi-level selection.
Of course.
And
of course, but it's so interesting that ideas become popular because they satisfy the powers that be.
Yep.
And also because they're easy, it's like junk food. It's just easy yep. to eat it, so it becomes popular. It's not nutritious. And this idea of the survival of the fittest is like, oh, I get that.
Yep.
Right, that makes sense. Plus, it, you know, feeds into capitalism and a narrative. That...
well, and a very specific form of capitalism.
I mean, right.
It's, you know, Jeff Skilling's favorite book was The Selfish Gene.
Hmm.
And then he runs his company Enron on that basis.
Right.
He does the real world experiment. He does the real world experiment of this selfishness only narrative.
Like an Ayn Rand
yeah,
kind
exactly.
of economic model.
And what actually happens? The company fails. Because yeah. what ends up happening is that everybody's out for themselves.
Right.
And there's no trust and there's no cooperation. And so Enron doesn't function as a corporation. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you have Pixar. Pixar has this great healthy culture where, you know, people really sort of work together. They are learning each other's skills. They're collectively trying to solve problems. and it continues to lay golden eggs, right? That's how the goose is supposed to work. That's how a tribe is supposed to work.
Right.
But the, so yeah, part of it is the gene-centric thing, and then part of it is the selfishness thing. Right. And, you know, David Sloan Wilson and E.O. Wilson came up with this very simple phrase, which is, selfish individuals outcompete altruistic individuals, altruistic groups outcompete selfish groups. So, and there's actually, there's experiments they've done with this. Have you ever heard of the water striders, the rapey water striders?
The bugs?
Yeah, it's amazing. So there apparently there are these two variants of water striders. There's a rapey version and then a nice guy take you out to dinner version. And if you have a group that is mixed of rapey water striders and nice guy water striders, the rapey water striders do much better. You know,
they, in terms of reproducing.
Reproducing, yeah, and producing more individuals. But if you have a group that is all rapey water striders and then all nice guy water striders, the group with the nice guy water striders is much more fertile and productive because the females in the rapey group are so traumatized.
Right.
And it seems like the carrying capacity for rapey is about 1%. That's sort of the level that it can support. And it seems to be about the same level as psychopaths. That psychopaths may be a strategy that works at a certain low level in the population, but doesn't work when you have the entire tribe doing that.
See, theoretically, I see some weak points in that. Mm-hmm. First of all, 1% doesn't mean that it's working at 1%. It might just mean that it's a naturally occurring anomaly that happens 1%. At 1% that never gets totally wiped out because it happens through random genetic selection or fetal conditions or whatever. The issue I have with their sort of thesis that selfish individuals outcompete altruistic individuals is that if you look at the context of hunter-gatherers, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big issue that's raised by Dawkins and Steven Pinker and other neo-Hobbesian theorists who, you know, they look at the sort of game theory model of hunter-gatherer groups and they say, well, they couldn't be egalitarian because you'd have a selfish infiltrator who would come in and he would take over and he'd refuse to work and he'd want to fuck all the women and like they'd be defenseless against him.
Right.
But in fact, that's not how hunter-gatherer groups work. When you have an asshole like that, they ridicule him first. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't work, someone will sit him down and talk to him and like make it clear that this is an issue. If that doesn't work, he gets an arrow in the back.
Yeah.
Because have you ever read Christopher Bohm?
No, we last time I was here, we talked
it's
about
very,
him.
I have one of his books around here, Something in the Forest, Equality in the Forest or something like that. He's an anthropologist who's done, as far as I know, he's done the most work looking at how hunter-gatherer groups, the dynamics by which they maintain an egalitarian social dynamic.
Well, this is very much David Sloan Wilson's work, too. So Darwin's Cathedral all begins with hunter-gatherers and hunter-gatherer behavior.
Right.
And about how egalitarian they are, and when they make a kill, the first thing they do
share,
is share it. They drag it into the middle of the circle so everybody can see it. They feed themselves last. They give themselves.
They share arrows so nobody even knows whose arrow killed it.
So he's very much on the same line.
So in what sense does he believe that selfish individuals outcompete altruistic then?
Well, the point is that...
Or is he not talking about humans?
Well, he's talking about that as potentially as a... He's saying the place where selfishness can play out. And I think the other thing, too, is it becomes about large-scale societies. So if you're beyond the Dunbar number, then it becomes very hard, potentially, to spot and track the defectors. Whereas within the Dunbar number and within a hunter-gatherer group, the point is that we're very good at spotting, Ung over there is not doing his part.
Ung over?
Yeah, so when I was on... when I was on Rogan, we were talking about this, and he like named the hunter-gatherer the Ung. And that, you know, every time we go out for guavas, Ung never goes. And then he eats all the fucking guavas.
Yeah.
And then he said, he literally basically, you know, on a fairly intuitive level, I think, talked through what happens to Ung, right?
Yeah.
And is like, well, first thing that happens is that, you know, we call Ung out on his shit, and then we like fucking take him out.
Yeah, Ung has a hiking accident.
Exactly. We take him for a walk, and he never comes back.
Well, Bohm makes an interesting point. You know, you're talking about culture gene coevolution. There's also that sort of coevolution happens in humans as hunter-gatherers. He makes the point that we have been armed for a very long time. And so it doesn't matter who's bigger. It doesn't matter who, you know, who boasts more and who... everyone's capable of killing you at 30 yards, right? Yep. And they're very, very good at it. So that sort of, I think it, you know, undermines this argument of the selfish infiltrator.
Yep.
How is one asshole going to take over a group of, you know, 50 armed people?
Well, and also the other problem too is, you know, and this is Henrik, like he has this chart that I just think is maybe the most important chart in human history. Because it's literally
more
like,
than the Bristol turd scale.
Okay, it's second.
Yeah,
after this is number two after the number two chart. but it's they give an intelligence test to a chimp, an orangutan, and a human toddler.
Mm.
And you know, on this intelligence test, on causality, on spatial intelligence, and on quantities, we are either as smart or dumber than the chimp. There's only one area in which we're off the chart smarter, and that's social intelligence.
Mm.
And we are the hyper socially intelligent ape. And so if you have some interloper coming in,
right,
we're really quick at spotting who
and
is now
gossiping
pulling
about
away,
it.
Gossiping and all of that. So that's something that we can all observe in our own lives.
Yeah.
Like if you're with a group of people and it's clear that you know, you so-and-so hasn't done any of the cooking. They haven't done any of the cleaning.
People notice really
quickly.
Yeah. By the way, I have to thank you. I think it was the last time you were here, you mentioned, and maybe you even sent it to me or something, but there was an essay, I can't remember the author, but it was about how can you know what the blind spots are in your own culture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about? It was like, he said, you know, we look back at earlier generations and we think, how could they have possibly have thought that women were dumber than men and that blacks were inferior and whatever, and the homosexuality was a disease. And so are there ways, I think you recommended this to me, are there ways to look at our own culture and determine what our blind spots are and what mistakes we're making? Does that ring a bell for you?
It sounds like the sort of thing I would send, but I don't remember sending it.
So I wonder who it was.
I'm kind of tempted to claim credit for it. Well, but I also know that because this
But you
is,
should read it. So
you should.
If you claim credit, then I won't send it to you. You know, well, you have to cover your tracks.
Well, but the other problem too is that, you know, we are, I mean, this is why I have real hope for the internet, right? We're doing this podcast to literally hundreds of millions of people listen to this, and you know,
and that's not even counting China.
That's not even. I mean, we're huge in China, dude. But you know, there are a lot of our fellow hyper socially intelligent apes out there, and you know, they'll figure out real fast if you're full of shit, and they will call you out on it. So
don't lie.
So that's
don't
the point.
Lie to Uncle Chris.
I think that, you know, now those what's happening is that this technology enables those within the Dunbar number hunter-gatherer dynamics,
right,
where we're able to sort of police each other and call out defectors
at a
and
much
call
higher
out miscreants
scale.
At a
yeah.
much higher scale. So I'm going to go ahead and say I didn't send you
didn't.
That article,
well, good.
And I'd like to read it.
I'll send it to you because it was really, it's very interesting. It's no more than 10 pages long. But yeah, he basically says, okay, we look back, we see how mistaken they were. We think, how could that have happened? And it feels like we're not making those fundamental errors, but of course we know we are.
Yeah.
So how can we, what are some techniques that we can use to figure out where we're totally off base, right? And one of the things he says, that there are three or four of the techniques. The only one that comes to mind right now is, look at things that cannot be said.
Ooh.
Look at taboos.
Yep.
Because the cloud, the sort of shadow of taboo hides this fucked up thinking.
Right.
And so getting back to shitting and, you know, fucking and like
the big seven.
Talk about the things that people don't talk about in polite company. And that's where you're going to find room for a lot of improvement and a lot of, you know, increasing your intelligence.
Well, I think
you won't get invited back to the dinner party necessarily.
Yeah, but you'll get invited to a better dinner party. A dinner party with Uncle Chris.
Hey, do you ever see the Buñuel film where everyone's sitting around a table at a big dinner party? Do you know Buñuel?
Yeah.
I forget which film this is, but they're all sitting around a table and it's a fancy party, class, the general and the bishop and all these. And as the camera pans out, you realize there's no food on the table. They're all sitting there talking and drinking. And the camera pans back and they're all sitting on toilets. And they're all just shitting together.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to a guy like gets up and says, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." And he leaves and he goes to this little room and he eats by himself, all ashamed in the bathroom. Yeah.
It's so funny.
And Buñuel was great about that. Flipping like, why is this a social activity and this is shameful? Yeah. So you'll get invited to the shitting dinner party.
Sounds amazing. But in practice, you know, your shitting dinner party, there's no toilets. It's just like the Asian squat toilet, right?
Yeah. So we'll hold it outside. I think it's best.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
It's even better. And that's how you're going to, you know, find out who are the girls that you're interested in. Because any you just clear up what the dinner party is about. And if, you know, if chicks don't show up and they're not down for shitting in public.
Well, and also you want to see what their stool is. If it's a three or a four.
Then you that's know, a keeper.
That's a girl. That's a keeper.
I'm going to need to see a stool sample before we take this any further.
This is why we're so big in China.
Because they love it.
Because they love
it. It's the split pants, dude. Yeah,
I know.
The split pants are one of the greatest things in the world.
I remember I was walking. First time I went to India, I had been living in Midtown Manhattan. I bought a one-way ticket to New Delhi. So I was coming from a New York state of mind, Billy Joel reference, to India. And that's a long, that's a long trip, right? So I was probably in India about a month before my head got there. And I can remember the day, the place. I remember everything about it. And it featured me walking. I was in Pushkar in Rajasthan. And I was in this cafe where I'd had a Bang Lassi, which is like a marijuana milkshake.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was walking back to this place where I was staying. And I started to get a buzz from the milkshake, and I'm walking along, it's a dirt road, and there's a woman, an old woman up ahead of me, and I see her pull up her dress and squat in the gutter by the side of the road, and I'm walking along, and I'm feeling weird, like, you know, this woman's taking a dump, and I'm walking along, and I don't want to stop, and I don't know what to do, and so I just sort of walk along like it's no big deal, and as I get closer to her, I see she's looking at me, and I'm like, don't want to look at her, but she's looking at me. So I look at her, and she's got this big smile on her face, and she holds out her hand. Like, I think she's like wants me to help her up or something. No, she just wants some money.
So oh my God.
So she's like begging, smiling, and taking a dump at the same time. Total lack of shame.
Yeah.
And I remember just laughing and feeling like, whoa, I think I'm starting to get this place.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and then I walked by this cow.
Yeah.
And the cow just looked at me and I looked at the cow and it was just like, all right, I kind of get it. Like, you just got to move like a cow and slow and steady and keep it relaxed. And
so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So shitting, shitting's important.
Yep.
All right, so we're pushing 2 hours here. It feels like we just started.
Well, that's how it should be.
Hunter Motz.
Well, you know, it's
easy to chat with you.
Well, but, you know, I think that this is a good place to weave in your favorite T.S. Eliot quote.
My favorite T.S. Eliot quote. The end of all our travels will be to return to where but it starts earlier than that.
We shall not cease from exploration.
And the end of all our
travels will
be to return to where we began and know the place for the first time.
And I think that's how it every single time we podcast, it feels very much like that circular hero's journey.
We do a loop.
Yep.
Loop the loop. Yeah.
And each time we go a little bit deeper.
All right. Well, thank you for appearing on Tangentially Speaking.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks for coming on Mixed Mental Arts.
Oh, yeah. This is good. This is like a 69 of podcasts.
You're not Uncle Chris's van.
No, I'm going to take you out to the van.